Can a survey change the future? Maybe this one can. Cannabis education is inconsistent at best and missing or misleading at worst. How can we make cannabis education better? What if we ask people who use or are thinking about using cannabis a bunch of questions? What if we ask pharmacists who could be teaching people about cannabis a bunch of questions? And then, what if the answers from those questions were used to help pharmacists teach people about cannabis better? Well, this is exactly what pharmacists as cannabis educators, or PACE, are doing. And PACE needs you to fill out a survey. PACE needs as many people as possible to fill out a survey. PACE needs you to fill out a survey on or before May 12th. This is a limited time offer for you to help change the future of cannabis education. To participate, go to promo.reefermed.ca. That's promo, promo.reefermed.ca.
It's Reefer Madness, the podcast with Trevor and Kirk.
Kirk, we're back, and you brought us a very interesting lady from the States.
Yeah, you know, Trevor, I want to talk a little bit about what this episode means to me here. We go back to how we started this project and we had our wish list. One of my wish lists was to do an episode on prenatal patients, cannabis, and pregnancy. So in the last 4 weeks, I've been doing a lot of research and reading some papers on cannabis. And my goal, cannabis and pregnancy, my goal is to start a discussion about cannabis and the influence within my clinical practice. As you know, Trevor, in this project, we've often tried to find out information about cannabis, how it affects our practice. Cannabis and pregnancy, cannabis and prenatal programs, cannabis and breastfeeding, is something that I've wanted to touch upon since we started this project. And I need to start, as much as we are two men chatting about a woman's issue, I want to state up front that personally, women have the right to choose how to treat their body, right?
Okay.
So as two men, let's just put that out there.
Yeah.
I don't want it. This is not a debate on that. However, as a nurse, I often enter into a long debate of society's responsibility of the unborn child. To the extent that we know there's a lot of harm that comes from alcohol. We know that right now the clinical practice, clinical policies is that no alcohol is the best. Back in the day, doctors would recommend a Guinness, for example, right? And a goodness of Guinness would help a mother with breastfeeding. Well, we now know through research, through studies, through public policy, that alcohol is just bad. And we know, I know as a practitioner, I have delivered babies where the mother has been drunk. My practice, fetal alcohol spectrum disorder, is a big part of my practice, unfortunately. I work in corrections. I have worked in corrections. And as we know, a great body of the inmates, a great high percentage of inmates, can be put on the spectrum of fetal alcohol spectrum disorder. So I have input on that. I have knowledge about that. And so let's start this whole conversation that the best thing for a mother, a pregnant woman, is a proper diet and all drugs and all alcohol off the table, right? A healthy diet, right?
Yeah, that's not controversial.
Yeah, that's not controversial. So let's start the conversation by that. I recommend that. I understand that. That's important to me. Many years ago, about 20 years ago, and as you know through our discussions, I've been very curious about cannabis. And I can remember reading an article, and we called it the Jamaican study. And Dr. Sierra Torres, who we're
yeah, she called it exactly the same thing.
Yeah. So it was kind of cool because I remember reading the Jamaican study, and this is a very small study done by Dr. Melanie Dreyer. And I have reached out to her. Unfortunately, I think she's in retirement mode. But I've reached out to that study to talk to her. I've reached out to many, many, many authors in the last 4 weeks of studying this episode. And so my understanding of cannabis and prenatal started with the doctor, with the Jamaican studies. And the irony is that in the last 20 years, I've never seen anybody refer to it in clinical practice. And I've always wondered why. Now, one of the reasons, of course, is that it's a very small sample size. The study has 33 mothers that were using cannabis and drinking tea and 27 non-users. What made this an interesting study for me back in the day was that it was very easy for the researchers to isolate the sample of those that do cannabis, those that don't. Because one of the biggest problems in researching cannabis is the fact that many of the sample sizes, people drink alcohol, people smoke cigarettes, people might have antidepressants, people have, you know, social economic issues, low income, low education, low social economic standing. And so it's very difficult to isolate cannabis and a mother's relationship. We found somebody, Dr. Sierra Torres, who basically went out there and started with 1,500 studies, narrowed it down to 45 studies, and she has isolated the relationship between cannabis and the mother and removing the other factors, and has come down to the fact that they don't necessarily see any difference in cognitive behavior of the baby.
And I'm just going to jump in and she touches on this too, but so what she did was called a meta-analysis, which is good. It's just, but it's a study of studies, meaning she didn't, and we'll get to a reason why she can't, but she didn't take, 1,200, pregnant mothers and give them cannabis and 1,200 pregnant mothers and give them something else they're smoking that seemed like cannabis. You know, this was not a double-blind placebo-controlled trial. And it wasn't also what we call a natural experiment where, let's say New Jersey legalized recreational cannabis. So you had a whole bunch of mothers self-declaring they're using cannabis where, next door in New York, it wasn't. So you had a whole bunch of, so we didn't, it wasn't a study of participants, which is kind of our gold standard. But on the other hand, it's, as she mentioned, she used to do experiments in rats where she could control everything. You can't do that in people. People, it's hard. You have to sort of take as much as you can and then apply some fancy stats to it.
But she was able to go back to those studies and remove the correlations between the low social economics, low education, and just isolate. If you look at cannabis and pregnancy, are there any correlations between the cognitive ability of the child later? And the reason why this is important to me is because a lot of the literature that's out there for me to practice, for my practice, is that all drugs and all alcohol is bad, right? Now, we've said that already, that the best thing for a mother is a balanced diet and no drugs, no alcohol. But what was happening is that when a woman says that she identifies as a cannabis user, some of those women were losing their babies. And what they were able to find out, and this is another study, like I said, Trevor, I've reached out to several studies here. One of the studies I want to talk, that I've reached out, and this is by Dr. Mark and Dr. Turpin. They did a study on cannabis and pregnancy, maternal child health implications during a period of drug policy liberation. And what they found out is that women that identified as being cannabis smokers were having the children removed. And then following those children and discovering that by going into the system, there may be more harm done by removing a child from a pot-smoking mother, that there is, so there might be more harm doing that than the mother who's smoking pot during pregnancy. The point is that with this episode, I want to start the discussion. Obviously, we need more studies, right? Obviously. And Dr. Torres talks about that. We need more studies. But what she does come out to say is that maybe some of the public policies that are out there right now might be a little
draconian.
Yeah, when it comes to cannabis, right? Going back to the Jamaican studies, what makes that study very unique? Dr. Torres talks about it, but we never really discussed, she talks about it being unique because it's outside of Canada, or outside of the United States and Canada. What I think the reason why it makes it unique is it because they've been naturally able to remove all the other criteria. No one's snorting coke in this cohort. This is a cohort of cannabis versus non-cannabis. And following these children over the last 20 years, and there's been successive studies on it, she says that she went back to 45 studies, and she later says that with those 45 studies, it goes back to,
In the 70s. So it was from the 70s till today.
So they're following it. So essentially what they're finding is that when it comes to cannabis, removing all other social economics, cannabis may not be as harmful to babies as we thought. This is why I wanted to bring this forward. This is why this is an important to me.
All right. And you know what? I think that's enough preamble. Let's listen to Dr. Torres.
So my name is Sierra Torres. I'm a neuroscientist, and I also teach at Columbia University in the Department of Psychology. And my area of focus is recreational drugs, and more recently, specifically, marijuana.
Okay, wonderful. And your background, you have a PhD?
Yes, I have a PhD in neuroscience.
Okay. And some of your research has been in cannabis. How did you fall into becoming a cannabis researcher?
So we kind of fell into it in two main ways. One of them, kind of the less interesting way, is that just because cannabis is the most commonly used illicit drug, so that's obviously just makes it interesting just because of that. But more interestingly, because I heard at some point in the middle of my PhD that sometimes a positive drug test for a woman that just gave birth for marijuana is enough to separate the family from the newborn baby. So if the mother has exposed through pregnancy, the baby to marijuana, that's kind of seen enough to accuse the mother of neglect or abuse. So that was kind of part of the inspiration for the paper. And the idea was, well, you know, do we really kind of have evidence suggesting that we really, really need to be that worried about prenatal marijuana exposure to be able to warrant families being separated from newborns? So that's kind of how it started.
Okay. That's actually quite interesting. So you were doing your PhD and you discovered that women were being harmed by the law, I guess, the justice system, because they declared that they were consuming cannabis. So that got you into studying cannabis and pregnancy. So where has your discoveries taken you? What have you discovered?
So we wanted to basically look at this question systematically in a way, because as you might know, if you just choose one study, you might have an answer of yes, there's an effect. If you get another study, no, there's not an effect. So instead of looking at one individual study versus the other, we wanted to take the entire literature, every study that had ever been done on this particular topic, and see what the summary is really after decades of research on the topic. And let me clarify that there's many potential effects that marijuana can have in and out of pregnancy, but the one that I did look at specifically was the effect of prenatal cannabis exposure on cognition specifically.
Okay, and what did you discover?
Well, I discovered when I took all of that together, we discovered that basically in the overwhelming majority of the cases that children exposed to marijuana prenatally do not perform any different from children that have not been exposed to marijuana prenatally.
That's fascinating. Why is that not out there more?
Well, there might be many reasons. First of all, kind of no one had really done a review of this type, right? If it had been done, we wouldn't have done it ourselves, of course. So that's one reason. The other reason is maybe that it's obviously not a popular kind of fact to have out there, right?
Right. So when did you do this paper? When was the paper dated?
I believe it was May 8th of this year.
That's 2020. So this
published.
Is brand new. Yeah. This is brand new study.
Super new.
Okay. And so are you getting much attention?
Yeah, there's been some attention. I already did an interview with the Chronicle of Social Change in Texas, and I also was interviewed recently by Forbes.
Right, and I've read that article. That's a fascinating article. I'd like to stay a little longer on the cannabis. I've been nursing some, I guess, more than 30 years, almost 40 years. And I can remember back in the 90s, Dr. Melody Dreyer, you did a lot of research. Do you remember her paper at all?
It was the Melody
yeah. Dreyer. She did the Jamaican study.
Yeah, I do remember.
Yeah, I was always very curious because I've raised that study with many people over the years about it being significant because it was a specific audience. They were able to actually, you know, you've got one group that's been cannabis exposed and one group that's not, albeit a small group. Did you find other studies like that?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. So in the paper that we published that addresses all of the literature, I think we ended up with 45 separate studies. The Jamaican study, and I'm laughing because that's how we also knew it as the Jamaican study.
Yeah.
And we do know it as the Jamaican study because it's so uncommon in the literature to have any kind of studies going on outside of North America, so U.S. and Canada. So I really appreciated that one of the studies was done somewhere else, you know, because kind of all of the ideas that we have on this topic come from Canada and the U.S. when there's so many countries out there, obviously, right? So we definitely do have to expand to other places, to other cultures, to everywhere, right? Not just stay in this part of the world.
Mm-hmm. What were some of the limiting issues you found in some of the studies? And I mean by that, I guess, using the Jamaican study as our foundation, because it's so easily depicts a population of cannabis users against a non. Did you find that there was a blend of other drugs and alcohol abuse that went in with the cannabis? So when people said, you know, drugs are affecting babies, they did a cauldron of stuff. Were they able to pinpoint cannabis in the studies you looked at?
So as you said, many of the people that use cannabis might use other drugs, and that might include some things that we normally don't even think about as drugs, right? So alcohol and tobacco being the main ones that, because they're so socially acceptable, we don't think about as drugs, but they are, right?
Right.
So it's definitely very common for the participants in these studies to be using other drugs. The way that researchers kind of deal with that is that they use kind of statistical methods or of data analysis to be able to, as best as they can, separate what they think is the contributing kind of effect of these different other factors. And that just doesn't include drugs, because of course we can fall in the trap of thinking, well, we only have to control for other drugs, but that's not true. We have to control for socioeconomic status. We have to control for the home environment. We have to control for the education of the mother, of the father, how many people live in the house. There's all these factors that are contributing even separately from other drugs that we're considering.
Right. So in your study, you're able to do that and basically come up that if you look at cannabis and pregnancy as two relationships, there's no evidence that suggests there's an impairment to the baby cognitively.
So we didn't engage with the actual participants, the mothers and their children. We didn't do that ourselves. What we did was evaluate how the researchers that did those experiments, how did they come up with these conclusions, right? So if you're telling me something like prenatal marijuana exposure decreases attention, right, on the child, I'm going to be then able to look at that paper and say, well, did you really take into account that they also smoke tobacco? Or did you not take it into account? Right. And if you did not take it into account, then that is something that I definitely noted in my own paper, right? To say, this is the conclusion, but is it really a conclusion when this was not controlled for, or this was not taken into account?
Okay. All right. So you're able to do that. So when I look at, and I'm just scrolling here, you can still see me, I assume. I'm scrolling here. I'm looking at the Canadian Center of Substance Use and Addiction. And they're basically clearing the smoke of cannabis. They're making statements such as, cannabis is a illicit drug most commonly used, as you said. There are frequent uses of cannabis is associated with low birth weight, and parts of the cluster of risk factors correlate with adverse birth outcomes. Now, you didn't find any of that in your studies?
So I was not focusing on that.
On birth weight.
I was only on cognition.
Okay.
All yeah. Right. There's a whole, there are reviews about that, but every kind of piece should be evaluated very differently, right? So let's say that I do not find any association between prenatal cannabis exposure and cognition. That doesn't necessarily rule out that another potential relationship might be found. So okay. All of these things need to be taken separately.
Okay. All right. And you also found in your study about the, social determinants of health, and we kind of touched on that, the justice system. Tell me a little bit about that study, how you've discovered women in the justice system who have admitted to cannabis smoking.
Oh, so I didn't do that particularly in the study because this study was not about that. I just know that anecdotally, I know that this is happening, for example, in New York City. This is where I was when I originally learned about this. And I did learn about it through the National Advocates for Pregnant Women,
okay.
who works with a lot of women in New York City who might lose their newborn children because of positive drug tests. I also eventually got actually involved in these cases. Because sometimes the judges that are involved in these cases want an expert witness to kind of talk about, well, what does prenatal cannabis exposure do? Because I'm saying that this woman neglected or abused her newborn because she exposed them to cannabis. So basically through those experiences of being an expert witness for these cases, I was able to learn more about that particular topic and, of course, use what I was finding in my study of the scientific evidence on it to, write letters to the judge that are working on these cases and kind of help in that way.
Okay. Where do you think your study's going to do? How is it going to go forward? How do you think it's going to affect healthcare, I guess?
Well, I don't know what it's going to do because in the ideal world, of course, I would say something like, I hope that the scientific evidence does something so that public policy is aligned with it, right? That's mm-hmm. what the ideal would be. But that doesn't always happen, right? As we know, studies come out every day, right? And we all like to think of the idea that public policy is aligned with science, but that's not necessarily true. If it were, we wouldn't be having situations like mothers being separated from their babies because of a positive marijuana test. So that would be kind of the ideal. But another thing that I'm hoping that comes out of this particular study is that another thing that we did evaluate was, okay, even in the minority of the cases when there is an association between prenatal cannabis exposure and cognition, what does that mean, right? Because right. if I'm telling you that there is a difference, what is that, right? So what we were looking at in this paper was when we say a difference, it means a statistical difference, right? So if I take the third floor in your building, right? Everyone that lives on the third floor and everyone that lives on the second floor, they might have different IQs. That might just happen. Maybe your floor has a higher IQ than the other floor. And that would give a statistical difference. However, does that mean that one of the two floors with the lower scores needs help to improve their cognitive scores, their IQ? Not necessarily, right? So that's the difference between what we call statistical difference versus clinical difference.
Okay.
So a social worker will say, oh, you got a 98 IQ. You don't need help. I don't need to give you therapy because you're still within the normal range. So I'm hoping that from this paper, we kind of pay attention more to what a clinical difference means. Am I really seeing that this person is going to have an impairment in their day-to-day life? Or are they going to be able to function, even though in general there might be a little higher or a little lower? So that's my kind of second ideal hope with this paper.
Now, you've got a background with mapping the brain and drugs. I was listening to you in another interview. Now, what is that?
What do you mean by mapping?
Well, I was listening to in a podcast, and basically you were talking about how in your studies you're looking how the brain is affected by drugs.
Ah, so that was long ago in my PhD. So what I was doing back then, not related to this paper, but it was also with recreational drugs, I was seeing how amphetamine affected particular areas of the brain, if it did or if it did not. So before I got into this project, I was trying to see basically how methamphetamine works in the brain. I would do experiments on mice, kind of inject them with amphetamine, see if this protein or this molecule in the brain changed or if it stayed the same. And that's what I did for many years during my PhD.
Okay. All right. So you did, that has nothing to do with the cannabis story.
No, no. So I actually started my drug life with amphetamines.
Okay. From your paper, now, is this the only research you've done specifically on cannabis? Have you done other research?
So apart from this huge paper, I've done a couple of letter to the editors. I don't know if you're familiar with that term.
Yeah.
Basically what we do is we see a literature that has recently been published on these topics, and we see if there's any kind of limitations that we're concerned of, and including cannabis and other drugs, the limitation that typically comes out is the one that I mentioned. Just because you see a statistical difference doesn't mean there's really a problem.
Okay. How do I apply the research you've done to my clinical practice? Now, as a nurse, I will have prenatal day and I do prenatal assessments. And I do talk about drugs and alcohol, obviously, because it's part of the tick boxes I go through. How does your research apply to my clinical practice?
Well, I think in a way that's kind of limited by where you're practicing, of course, because there are places where kind of the clinicians are left to decide whether they have to report someone or not, right? Because of a positive drug test, or because you suspect that they might be using drugs even apart from a actual toxicological report. So if you're in a place like that, then I mean, I would think that if you already know that the medical professionals are determining that a baby is healthy, right? There's really nothing to do just because someone might be using drugs. But I do recognize that there are many places where clinicians are basically mandated to report whether they suspect something like that. And if, of course, there is a toxicology to prove it.
Okay, so that goes back to policy. You're saying that hopefully studies can dictate public policy as we go. Okay, fair enough.
Hopefully, yeah.
Yeah, and I guess just as a practitioner, my relationship with the patient, I might share the data as I understand it, but I still have to follow the employer policy, I guess.
Of course. I mean, if you have a situation where you're not mandated, of course, and you happen to come upon a patient who admits to you, yes, you know, I smoked marijuana one time 5 months ago in the middle of my pregnancy, you can use something like this, you know, when you put it, we try to write it, of course, as in much layman terms as possible. Yeah. You can kind of share this to I would hope, you know, make the person feel better, you know, that just because they smoked one time 5 months ago during pregnancy doesn't mean the baby's going to be unhealthy, basically.
Right. Okay. That's sort of what I was looking for. Is there anything I didn't ask you about your paper or about relationship with cannabis and how pregnant women If you were to give advice to a pregnant woman, what would your advice be?
I try to refrain from giving advice because, you know, I think it's a personal decision, whatever you're doing during pregnancy. I do think that it's important, however, to, you know, recognize that apart from cannabis, there are many things that could affect pregnancy, right? If you're not sleeping the right way, if you're not eating the right way, if you're smoking too much tobacco, if you're doing whatever, it's just one of the potential factors that could affect anything. And everything really, you know, with anything depends on how much you do it, right? Oh. You take too many Tylenols, one Tylenol enough, you could technically, you know, damage your liver, or you could have some sort of overdose. So dose is really, really important as well.
Dosing.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Explain.
So what I mean is, for example, alcohol. If you take a glass of alcohol, and that's going to be a totally different experience than if you take 2 gallons of alcohol within an hour. You know, it could really mean the difference between just feeling nice and more social in a boring event, or it could mean death, right? So you can stop breathing. So dose is really important. That also becomes important when you are kind of working with different experience with alcohol. So if I never drink, I could be technically drunk with after two cups of something, right? But someone that's used to it might need 8 bottles of beer to really get drunk. So it also depends on how tolerant you are. It depends on the type of environment you're in. Right. If I'm smoking marijuana, and one of the potential negative side effects of marijuana is paranoia, is it better for me to go and smoke marijuana next to a police precinct or in my house while I'm like chilling with my friends, right?
Right.
So a lot of things go into the experience. Dose is one of them. How experienced you are with the drug is another one of them, and the environment, of course.
Yeah. No, I like the way, when I was reading through your papers, I like the way you do differentiate that if you're looking specifically at cannabis, there's nothing that we see that affects the cognition of the child, but all the other factors have to be in play. Where you're living, your income, your education, your diet, all the other things that go into healthy babies. But if we just take the cannabis away, it's not a concern. We can look at the other issues. So don't take a baby away because mom says she had a spliff.
Well, that day. Yeah. I mean, it's kind of we're in a way limited by reality, right? So the reality is that, of course, the way we do these experiments, it's with real people, right, that are out there in the world living their lives. And compared to when I was doing experiments in mice, where absolutely everything could be controlled, and I can really figure out, is this an effect of methamphetamine or not? Because everything was controlled. And it's the same kind of concept whenever you're doing research with people and searching for these associations between this and that. Of course, they can exist, but sometimes it's hard to figure out whether something is having a positive effect or a negative effect, because people are people, right? We're all so different. So we have to keep that in mind, that that's a limitation of just doing research with people in any case, including cannabis.
How many papers did you review?
We started with like 1,500 papers. And out of those 1,500, we had to determine which ones really met the criteria for what we were going for. What do I mean by that? We get 1,500, but let's say 1,000 of those might not be in people. They might be in mice or rats. So that's not what I was trying to look at, right? So I have to exclude all of those. And then there were other exclusion criteria. So we end up with 45. So that's, that could be the entirety of the research on the topic since the late 70s, early 80s.
Okay. And that's the window of the studies was 70s and 80s. There's been no studies recently?
Oh yeah, that's when it started.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah, that's when it started, but we go up until now.
Yeah, the Jamaican study happened, I think, in 94, and then they did a five-year study after that. Do you know if there was any other studies 5 years again, 10 years? Because that study's now, geez, I guess almost 20, 30 years old, 1994.
Yeah, I'm glad you're asking that because going back to my Jamaican point, another issue is that not only are we doing the majority of the studies with populations in the U.S. and in Canada, but we're also, like I'm saying 45 studies, but most of the studies come from two studies that started decades ago. And they start looking at the mothers when they're pregnant. Then they test the kids at 1 year old, 3 years old, 7 years old. And they go now, I think now they're like late 20s, right. 30s. So it has kind of been, all of these studies have mostly been looking at the same kind of people okay. throughout all decades.
Okay.
So, yeah. Yeah. That's, so it's cohorts that have been studied for decades, most of them.
Interesting. So I look forward to seeing how your paper applies to clinical studies. I'm involved with lots of cannabis debates, and pregnancy and cannabis is always a debate, and everyone always says, well, we know so much. We don't. and we assume so much. And I think in medicine, it's easier, you know, the whole thing, do no harm. If we don't know anything, we might as well just say, don't do it.
Yeah. Which is, you know, it makes sense in a way, right? Because we're trying to protect in a way. But it does obviously come with this assumption that if we don't know, it might be that there's a negative effect. But right. What about the equally likely possibility that there might also be a positive one?
Exactly.
So if we don't know, we have to, I would love for us to assume equally or give attention to the two possibilities instead of just one.
Fantastic. Is there anything else you'd like to say? Is there any question I didn't ask that you expected from me?
No, not really. I mean, okay. you're the expert at doing questions, so I assume you're... You have done great.
Well, I'm just also dancing around the technology as well.
Thank you so much for having me.
Kirk, we're back. She is a very, very interesting woman. You know, another very smart researcher that I'm always amazed when these smart people agree to talk to us.
Yeah, I agree too. It's nice. It's nice when they talk to us and we got a good conversation out of it.
So back to your central theme. Now, what I thought going into this was, because I, you know, as a pharmacist, I get questions about drugs and pregnancy every day. That's, you know, a standard question. And my usual answer is, if it's something you can eliminate, do it. You know, if you don't have to use that cough and cold product, don't. If you don't have to, you know. So, and we talk about alcohol and we talk about tobacco a lot. Honestly, we don't talk about other drugs much because most people just don't admit they're using any other drugs. But we talk about that a lot. And my standard answer, and I think still is, if you were a recreational cannabis user, stop. You know, that's just the safest. But what gets to be more interesting, and I'll get to Dr. Torres in a second, but what would be kind of more interesting is sort of in pharmacy world, if you were epileptic, we know some of the epilepsy drugs are harmful to fetuses, but we also know seizures are harmful to fetuses. So, you know, what do you do when an epileptic on one of these drugs gets pregnant? Well, you know, you either do nothing, you try to switch them to possibly a less harmful drug, but, you know, there's not the option of stop it because, you know, the disease is not good. You know, we have seizures during pregnancy. That's not good for fetuses. So that's clinically more difficult and more interesting. So I was thinking about, you know, what if we have somebody who's using cannabis medicinally and it really is the only thing that's helping them? what do I say then about, you know, I'm pregnant and I'm using, it could even be epilepsy, you know, I'm pregnant and I'm using cannabis as part of my epilepsy treatment. What do we do? The answer is I don't know, but it's now more interesting to think about it. Probably it's going to be like every other one is, you know, can we possibly, you know, eliminate cannabis and some of your other seizure medications before you're pregnant? Maybe. If we can't, then, you know, it just might have to be a risk-benefit thing with the whole healthcare team. One of the things I never, I'll give you the floor back in a second, but one of the things I never considered during all of that sort of preamble and listening to it, I'd never even occurred to me, what about people who test positive for cannabis and have their kids taken away? Never even crossed my mind. And, you know, I think the problem with that policy is, you know, as a pharmacist and you as a nurse and all the health, you know, we're always risk versus benefit. So I think the policy hasn't done that. You know, what is the risk to the child if mom has been using cannabis versus what's the harm to, you know, what's the harm if we take the child away? And that was fascinating. I never thought about that because obviously taking the child away from mother in many cases is very harmful and probably way more harmful than the cannabis they were using during pregnancy.
Well, and that's the key, right? When, like, you raise a very good point. Cannabis has been medicine in Canada for 18, 15, 16, 18 years, right? So there are people out there that consume it. Now, when you remove all other things, if you give a lady a woman, a balanced diet, good exercise, she's got a good education, she's got good living wage coming in, she's got good housing, she got access to primary care practitioners, she has good social supports, she's got a nice warm place and a place to launder her clothing. And she's using cannabis during pregnancy. The suggestion is from this interview that we don't need to be fearful as practitioners that the baby's going to be harmed cognitively. I say that with a lot of caveats because we don't have the studies, but we do, you know, and this is what's so interesting. We just interviewed a neuroscientist who just did a study who says that cognitively we can't find any evidence that the child's impaired. So we do have a study that says and supports the fact that if the mother wants to continuing using the cannabis.
Well, but she was also, and it is a good study, but she was also very careful that it was very narrow. Like, for example, she doesn't know, then the study doesn't look at what does it do to birth weight? What does it, you know, there's a bunch of stuff this does not look at. Mm-hmm. So again, if you took, and still interesting clinically, and, you know, it becomes non-theoretical if you're the pregnant woman, but it's interesting clinically in, so if we have, because we tell pregnant women, and it's not bad things, but I remember when Doris was pregnant, a big deal at that point was unpasteurized milk. So, you know, feta cheese was going to, and there is a theoretical risk if you eat feta cheese during pregnancy, some, you know, protozoa is going to attack the fetus. Like it's a real thing. How likely? I have no idea. It was a tiny risk, but you know, when you're pregnant, it's all about trying to sort of eliminate risk. So again, back to, I don't think I would change my stance of if you are using cannabis recreationally and you got pregnant, should you keep, you know, it's just like, you know, if you drink beer recreationally, should you stop?
We have detailed studies.
Yeah, no, on alcohol, but I think still on the being safe, again, if you had a recreational, occasional user, and she asked me as a pharmacist, should I keep using this? I just like every, you know, same thing as she asked me, should I use this cough and cold medication? I'd say, if you can stop it, go ahead. But I think it's equally as important to go, well, like she said, you know, I smoked one joint, you know, in my second trimester. Well, don't beat yourself up about that.
Don't beat yourself up about it.
Or, you know, I smoked pot all the way through. Should I have my child removed? No, because that appears to be much more harmful. So there's a lot of nuances here.
Exactly. And that's the point of what I'm trying to do with this interview, is basically say there's lots of nuances. And as practitioners, and this is what, at the end of the conversation, we start talking about policy, right? And I said up front in the beginning of the episode is that as a nurse in a prenatal program doing prenatal assessments, I have a tick sheet. Tick, 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 tick. So I am mandated by MAP. It's a MAP, right? And Dr. Torres talks about it. If you're mandated by a MAP, et cetera. Now, my practice is a little unique. There's nowhere in my practice that dictates that I have to report a woman that is under the influence of any alcohol or any drug while pregnant. So I'm not out there reporting people. I'm not taking children away. But what I am doing is trying to understand how cannabis relates to my practice. And obviously, cannabis is out there. Nurses, pharmacists, doctors, we're going to confront it. This conversation basically tells us as practitioners that maybe research will eventually catch up to policy and we don't have to run out and be worried if we isolate cannabis as a mother's consuming cannabis. Now, having said that, in my research, I have stumbled upon an Australian study. This is an Australian study that I've reached out to the authors, and I'm trying to get them to talk to us. And this study is interesting. Canadian cannabis consumption and patterns of congenital abnormalities and ecological geospatial analysis. This gentleman has basically taken Health Canada statistics and analyzed it and compared it to our Nunavut and Northwest Territories and isolated a potential correlation between cannabis and Down syndrome and chromosomal abnormalities, congenital abnormalities to people who consume cannabis. So here's this conversation.
I immediately have many, many questions about what he did, but yes, no, if we can get that would be, right? That would be there's so many ways that study could be wrong / confounded /.
Well, I've read
but interesting. Interesting.
I've read the study. I don't want to raise it here because I want to talk to the authors of it. What I'm hoping, Trevor, is I'm hoping this is the first of many. To me, prenatal program is a very big part of my practice. And I want to get a lot of people's input on this. But I don't want to do it through fear. And a lot of the stuff that I am given as education for cannabis, and you know, to be honest with you, a lot of it, well, no, that's not true. There's specific education from the Canadian the Addiction Society of Canada in regards to cannabis. So I want to explore it. So Trevor, this is one of many. I'm hoping that we can find others. You did one of your pharmacy articles.
Yeah.
I reached out to her too, right? So hopefully back to us.
I would love to hear more about that too. But to wrap this one up,
okay.
Do you have music for this one, or are we going back to Renee?
No. I have music for this one.
I think I've heard you asking Dr. Torres if she had any thoughts.
Yeah, and she sent back some music. So Hector Lavey. I'll get somebody to pronounce it.
All right. No, that was another good one. Good job. That was, this will be very interesting if it turns into more than occasional series.
Cheers.
Well, time to blow this joint. Like the show? Let us know. We're Reefer Madness on Instagram and Facebook, at Reefer Madness on Twitter, or head over to the website at reefermed.ca to find out what we're all about and what's coming up next. Talk to you later.
thoughts.
Yeah, and she sent back some music, and I'm sorry, I must have closed the page. Take my glasses off. It's okay, here it is. It's Hector. So it's Hector. Where is he? Hector, is this the one? I think this is the one. Yeah, Hector, L-A-V-O-E, Lavoe, it's Spanish. Hector, okay. How do you say that? L-O-V-O-E.
We'll have to Google it. I wonder if it's Puerto Rican. We'll find
it
that
is,
out.
It is Puerto Rican. So okay. So you know what I'm going to do, Trevor, is I'll send you something and maybe I should have been prepared for you on this.
No, that's okay. This is going to be the Easter egg. I can feel it now.
Okay.